And this is it. It's called Unintelligent Debate. And subtitle, It's Time to Cool the Rhetoric in the Intelligent Design Dispute by John Wilson. And the article, it's about 6 pages long, is a critique of intelligent design strategy, which is something we've been writing on at Reasons to Believe. But we got mentioned in the article, and it's under the title, The Need for Intellectual Honesty. And I'll just read this paragraph. It says, whereas whole books published by various intelligent design figures have been devoted to meticulously unpacking some of the errors perpetuated in the Darwinist literature, they are virtually silent about the egregious intellectual errors that abound in young Earth literature. By contrast, Hugh Ross, who has some affinities with the intelligent design, has been more forthright. His work could serve as a model in this respect. And this did generate an anticipated reaction from the young Earth community. just one sentence, but Answers in Genesis decided to write 3 pages in response to that one sentence. I'm not going to read you the whole thing, but I'll read you one sentence out of the 3 pages. It says, the article in Christianity Today praises Hugh Ross, president of Reasons to Believe, who has been, quote, more forthright in his attacks on the young earth. They have that in quotes, but the article doesn't say attacks. The author, John Wilson, believes his work could serve as a model in this respect. In reality, Hugh Ross has followed a destructive pattern of twisting scripture and sloppy science to promote his own anti-biblical bias. And it says, see expose of the Genesis question book. So, but that kind of reminds me of what Pastor Dick was saying in class or in the church this morning. Those of you who have attended service will remember, he focused on Psalm 38, went through the whole Psalm. But at the end of the Psalm, David says this, I confess my iniquity, I am troubled by my sin. Many are those who are my vigorous enemies, those who hate me without reason are numerous, those who repay my good with evil, slander me when I seek what is good. O Lord, do not forsake me, be not far from me, O my God. Come quickly to help me, O Lord, my Savior. And I notice what David does here first is he clears his conscience, because everybody gets persecuted, but most people get persecuted because they're obnoxious. So King David says, I need to take care of that. I'm human, and I need to take care of the iniquity I've committed. And so he confesses his sin to God. But, you know, he's a vigorous proponent for God's truth and God's ways. And the point I got out of this, if you are, this is the reaction you're going to get. People will repay your good with evil, and they will come after you. And then David also makes the point, Lord, do not forsake me. Come quickly to help me. God will come quickly to your help. And, you know, this whole business here in the class of raising resources to send the book A Matter of Days to astronomers across the country, that's an answer to prayer for me. This class has come to rescue me from this. And, you know, it's just been amazing to watch over these past few weeks especially how for years we've been kind of alone taking the attacks from the young Earth community, but there are others that are now joining us. And, again, I really appreciate the fact that this class has stood with me through this and has helped support that. More good news. I got a letter from the Navigators, Nav Press, the people who have published the book A Matter of Days, and they said they're going to have to go to a second printing. The book is doing well, so that's good. So there are others that are coming to our assistance as well. A quick scientific discovery before we get into our text. And by the way, I'm so thrilled that our Los Angeles chapter is going to do this series on the soul. That's going to be the theme of our study in Job 39, how God switches gears from Job 38 focusing on the physical to Job 39 where he focuses on the soul. So I'm going to have to get the tapes and just see what you all come up with there. But a quick scientific discovery I want to report to you on. And if you've been listening to the radio or reading the newspapers, you know there's been a lot of hype about these 4 planets that have been discovered. And, you know, it's something we actually talked about a week ago, how there is this new discovery that was made where a group of astronomers in Britain wound up discovering that there are two pathways for planet formation. One pathway produces gas giants without rocky cores, and these are the kind of planets astronomers have been discovering outside of our solar system. But a much rarer pathway is a mechanism whereby planets form with rocky cores, and the rocky cores that are far away from the star accumulate gas. That's what Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus and Neptune are like. And then those that are close by, you get kind of the rocky core. That's Earth, Venus, Mercury, and Mars. And there was another planet that was there as well, but it collided into the Earth in a very blessed way. But the announcement I've been hearing on the radio repeatedly is that finally astronomers have found small rocky planets. And that kind of bothered me when I heard that, because nothing could be further from the truth. What they did find were four planets that are kind of the same mass as Uranus. So they're 17 times the mass of the Earth, but that means they're about 20, 30 times less massive than Jupiter. So a better term would be small Jupiters is what they're finding, because Uranus and Neptune have a lot of the features that Saturn and Uranus have. We do call all four of Uranus, Neptune, Saturn, and Jupiter gas giants. They're big planets composed mostly of gas. And it is true that Uranus and Neptune do have these cores. It's not true that these scientists have also established that these four planets they have found have rocky cores. All they've been able to establish is that they have minimum masses about the same as Uranus. And keep in mind, what they're discovering is a minimum mass, because what they're really looking at is the wobble in the star. You've got these unseen planets going around the star, and the gravity of the star will push and tug, pull and tug the star slightly. Because, you know, like Jupiter, as it goes around the sun, its gravity pulls on the sun and causes the sun to wobble a little bit in terms of its position. So that's the technique by which they're discovering these planets. They're seeing a wobble effect. And by measuring the wobble effect, they can determine what the minimum mass, not the maximum mass, is. Because the tug that the astronomer will see will be maximal if the planets are in the same line of sight as the astronomer's line of sight. If they're not, say if the planets are tilted, the plane of the planets is tilted relative to the observer, then that means that the mass necessary to get an observable tug will have to be much greater. And in that case, it's 17 times the mass of planet Earth, or it could be much greater, depending on the inclination. However, when you find four, that means you can kind of average it out, and not all of them are going to be high inclination. So my guess is they're coming in at about 20 to 30 times the mass of the planet Earth. But when they say they're proving that they're rocky, all they're saying is that they're the same mass roughly, or a little greater than Uranus and Neptune, and Uranus and Neptune are rocky, but the technique cannot tell whether these planets are gas all the way to the center, or they have a rocky core. You simply don't know. All you're measuring is the minimum mass. And you're also measuring the distance. And that's one of the reasons why you hear in the radio these are rocky small planets, because they're close to their stars. Well, actually, it doesn't prove a thing, because we know by this technique where planets form out of gas, like the other planets we're finding around these stars, those gas-forming planets will interact with the gas that remains, and that interaction causes the planets to drift in. So in our solar system, if a planet forms close to the star, it will be rocky. But in extraplanetary systems, not necessarily so. If it forms by the more common planetary formation route, which means condensation of a gas disk, it's guaranteed those planets will drift in toward the star. That drift will continue until the gas is exhausted. And all four of these planets are found orbiting very close to the star. Some of them take only 4 days to go around their star, which means they're orbiting their star far more closely than Mercury is orbiting our star. close enough that you're wondering, you know, what's keeping that thing from crashing into the sun. So, question? Yeah. Well, up till now, the planets they have been discovering have been like 300 to 1,000 to several thousand times the mass of our star, or mass of planet Earth. So these are small compared to the planets they've been discovering so far. Not compared to the Earth, but the news sources are right when they say these are the smallest planets that they have found so far. Actually, that's correct as of a little while ago. There's a new technique that I want to talk about here. This is the paper I wanted to mention. It's in the latest issue of Science. And I think what's interesting for a class here is that the research team involves a former member of this class. A few months ago, Eric Agol, the Caltech astronomer, was regularly attending the class. He's now doing research at another institution, so he's no longer here. But while he was at Caltech, he was a regular member of the class, sat back there in the corner. And Eric Agol's research program was a little bit different than another class member. I think we had Bijan Namati share with you. And he talked about the GPL program to send the space array telescope out that would actually be powerful enough to discover small planets orbiting around stars. Eric Agol is part of a much cheaper program to find Earth-sized planets. And this is the research. In fact, this is the first significant research result from the team. And they said instead of sending this very expensive array of telescopes into outer space that would be linked as an interferometer that could image things as tiny as a planet like Earth going around another star, they said, let's take advantage of the telescopes that are already there. And it's gravitational lensing. And what they're doing is they're looking at stars that line up behind other stars in a perfect line of sight. And they purposely look in places where the stars are very dense, which means you've got a high probability of finding these, quote, perfect gravitational lenses. And it would take a perfect gravitational lens to really get enough power to image planets as tiny as a planet Earth would be. And, you know, you've probably heard of gravitational lensing where they're looking at very distant quasars with a galaxy that intervenes. This is a much more powerful lensing effect because instead of using some amorphous massive body like a galaxy or a cluster of galaxies, you're using a very dense mass, a star. And what you're looking for is a star that's on the perfect line of sight. So draw a straight line from the astronomer's telescope out to a distant star, and you got a star exactly in the middle. And where you got a star exactly in the middle, it can act as a powerful gravitational lens, and basically the light is bent by general relativity, the mass of the star, and what you see is the image of the distant star, not as a point, but as a ring. You know, light is bent around the star, so you see this ring instead of a point of light. Now, what this team does is they look at that ring, and they're not looking at planets in the distant star, they're looking at planets in the lens. So here's a star that's acting as a lens. However, planets orbiting around that star will very subtly distort the image of the ring. Now, the bottom line is they wind up in the best situation of getting a magnifying power of 1,000 times. So it'd be like you were imaging this star with a telescope that's 1,000 times bigger than the one you're actually using, because the star acts as this powerful lens. Now, this paper isn't quite getting a factor of 1,000, but they're getting a factor of 500. So this is the first research result that they've come up with where they've got this perfect line of sight and they see this perfect ring and they look for tiny distortions in the ring. And that will tell them the whole suite of planets that exist around that star. Now, the particular star they picked was somewhat unfortunate for the team, because what they wound up publishing here, this star has no planets bigger than 1.3 times the mass of the Earth. So it's got no Jupiters, it's got no Saturns, it's got nothing like Uranus or Neptune. It's got nothing like planet Earth. That's slightly bigger than planet Earth. But they did say, this proves that the technique works and proves that we don't have to spend a few billion dollars building this array of telescopes in outer space. Although the JPL people come back and say, wait a minute, it's still worth going to the taxpayer to get those billions of dollars. Why? Because this technique with using gravitational lenses, you got to be lucky. You can't look at any star you want. You have to look at a star that just happens to lie along the perfect line of sight where there's a star between it and the observer. However, to say something in favor of Eric Agol's research team, there are places you can look in our galaxy where you have a very high probability of picking up these perfect lenses. When you look towards the center of the galaxy, what are you looking at? You're looking at 50 billion stars. And they're all in a rather small region of the sky relative to the observer, which means that with 50 billion stars lying within a few degrees, you've got a really high probability that a foreground star will line along the perfect line of sight. And that's basically what they did. They looked towards the galactic center and they found one. Now, I talked to Eric. They said they got a whole bunch. But it takes a while to process the data. And this is the first one where they've actually been able to process the data with enough detail to tell exactly what they're looking at, but he tells me they got dozens more that they'll be publishing in the next few weeks, months, and years. And they said, we haven't even looked at the globular clusters yet. That's another place where you can point your telescope. Like, for example, we looked at three globular clusters and we were up on the mountain. Each one we looked at has a minimum of 100,000 stars. And so, again, there's a good chance that one of the stars will line along the perfect line of sight of a foreground star that lies between us and the globular cluster. So there's other places we can look to find this. And this will really determine whether or not the research result I talked a week ago about how these British astronomers are saying there are two pathways for making planets, one common and one exceptionally rare. This is an experimental technique that will prove whether or not those Brits are right. Because if they're right, this technique will find all kinds of Jupiter, Saturns, Uranus, and Neptunes around other planets, but they're not going to find these small rocky planets orbiting at the right distance like we see here on planet Earth. You're first, and I'll go to you, Cliff. Well, what Eric has said, and I would agree with Eric, is the Jeff Marcy approach, which is looking for the wobbles. At least with Earth-based telescopes, that will never get you down to Earth-sized planets, no matter how close the star is to us. We are right now, I mean, with these four planets that they announced this weekend, you're hitting the theoretical limits of the technique. The technique can get you down to planets about the size of Uranus and Neptune, is not going to get you down to planets the size of the Earth. Eric Agol would say, and I would agree with him, this is the only technique that will not cost billions of dollars where you can go after planets the size of the Earth and even smaller planets than those that are the size of the Earth. So, Cliff. Well, that's the beauty of the technique, is that you keep observing the circle of light around the star, which is the gravitational lens effect. And as the planets go around the star, it will ripple or disturb the ring in different ways. And so that's what you do. You look at the frequency of the rippling, and that will tell you the period of the planet going around the star. And the amount of ripple will tell you the mass of the star and even the location of the star as it goes around. Oh, you have a different question?
If the Earth is moving to align with the star, and the stars themselves, everything's all moving, how long
right.
of a window do you have with 20
Earth? Oh, how long of a window do you have?
5 seconds.
Oh, no. No, you're talking like at least years. Okay. And, you know, a lot of it has to do, well, I mean, it depends. If the foreground star is really close to you, you've got less time. If the foreground star is a good distance away from you, its movement is going to be so small it's not going to affect things much. If it's within 100 light years, you're not going to have a very long time window. But this one, I forget the exact distance the star was, but it was a few thousand light years away from us, which means you're not going to have much disturbance based on the movement of the star as it goes around the galaxy relative to us. Yes. Okay, audio tape if you need it. But yeah, to get the bottom line on this initial result, they didn't find any planets. That was a little bit disturbing to the optimists for the life existence in the universe camp, and that they've been predicting all along that virtually every star would have a suite of planets. This is the first time a star has been observed in great detail, not just for big planets, but for small planets, and they came up with nothing. And so, only one result yet, but this is a technique that once it's exploited to a much greater degree will actually give us some real statistics on how many planets and what kinds of planets exist in our galaxy and whether or not Earth is exceptional or Earth is as common as corn in Iowa. Yes. Okay, that is the purpose, you're right. What's driving this whole research program is to demonstrate to the world at large that planets are common, planets like Earth are common, and life on planet Earth is multiplied throughout our galaxy and the universe. That's kind of where they're going with this. And if not, they say we're going to learn a lot about planets we don't know now. And that latter part is bearing true. How many planets have they discovered so far? There is 112 for which there's no doubt, extrasolar planets. But I would say probably 130 are well enough observed where we would concede they really do exist. Not a single planet have they discovered yet, or planetary system, would qualify as a candidate for even the most primitive life form. Every planetary system that we've observed has characteristics that would make it a non-candidate for life. The most common characteristics of making a non-candidate, the gas giants go around the planet closer than Jupiter does. Any gas giant closer than Jupiter would eliminate the possibility of life in our solar system. Jupiter is as close as you can possibly get without disturbing the possibility of life in our solar system. Well, Mars is not a gas giant, so there's no possibility for life on Mars for different reasons. Okay, but the other thing they're finding about these extrasolar planets, they have highly elliptical orbits. So instead of being circular like the orbits in our solar system, they are ellipsoidal. And ellipsoidal enough that that would mean that the giant planet would be closer to, quote, the life possible support planet at one point in its orbit than it would be at another point in the planet's orbit. So, and every planet we've discovered so far, either one of those is been observed or the other. So they're all non-candidates. And likewise, these four new ones that they found or announced this weekend are in the same category. Those stars with those planets, we now know, can't possibly sustain a life support planet. So yeah, we have zero stars with planets around them that would be possible candidates. And you know, the prediction we would make at Reasons to Believe, well, when we have 1,000 of them, it will be still zero. It's not going to be, you know, finding a whole bunch. But that's what this research will tell us. Yeah. Well, that's a good point. I mean, what if we do find a planet? Yeah, the planet was, what if we find a planet like Earth that has these conditions, and what does that prove? And, you know, we could find a planet around another star that's like Earth, that has the possibility to support life. There are a number of my colleagues at Reasons to Believe or astronomers who think that's exactly what's going to happen. We're going to find some of these planets. Why? Because they believe that God really enjoys creating. And their conclusion is, if we find one, that's proof that God did it. It's not proof that it's natural process alone that makes this happen. And the more we learn about the natural processes that are involved in the formation of planets, the more we're discovering that Earth is truly exceptional and demands divine miraculous intervention to explain its characteristics. But who's to say that God didn't do it more than once? Maybe he decided to have another planet out there in which dolphins are swimming in its oceans. Or maybe another planet where there's grass, or a planet where there's bacteria. That could be. God likes to create. The only scriptural restraint I see on this is what you find in Hebrews 9 and 10, where it tells us that Jesus Christ died one time, one place, for all. And it would seem to indicate that planet Earth is the only planet in the universe where there is intelligent life that is spiritual and soulish in nature, that has rebelled against God's authority and is in need of redemption. So, based on what we see in the book of Hebrews, that would be it. However, that passage in the book of Hebrews does not prove that God could have created planet X and loaded it up with dolphins. Dolphins wouldn't be in the category of being sinners and needing redemption, or grass. So, who knows? It's an open issue from a Christian perspective, which way we go. Yes. Yeah, this is something we addressed in our book, Origins of Life. It's on the table there, which says, well, how close do you have to be for life to be transported by natural process across interstellar space? The answer is, it's got to be interplanetary. Interstellar space travel of life forms is not possible. Interplanetary is. So on that basis, we've stated in our book that the planet Earth, because it is so prolific with life, has easily transported through the past 3.8 billion years its life to every solar system body. So as NASA goes out and looks at the moons of Jupiter and looks at Mars and the upper atmosphere of Venus, looks at the moon, they should find the remains of Earth life because of how much has been transported. In fact, there's a paper I mentioned to this class, I think a few months ago, where a group of three astronomers calculated how much Earth life is on the moon. And I think it's 10,000 kilograms per 100 square kilometers. That's a lot of life lying on the moon. And it shouldn't be that hard for NASA to go up there and find that stuff. It'll be quite broken down by the radiation that the moon experiences, but you should be able to find the chemical evidence for those remains. However, when you're looking at interstellar distances, the radiation through which the life would be exposed, whether it's embedded in dust or free-floating, it will be destroyed down to really simple molecules as it goes through interstellar space. So the only way you can get interstellar travel of life is if it's embedded in a rock that's at least 2 meters in diameter. It takes a whole meter of dense meteoritic material to protect any life form from the rigors of interstellar space. And that poses a problem because Earth receives one rock bigger than a few ounces from interstellar space every 10 to the 16 years. and that's a million times older than the age of the universe. So basically that probability is zero, and so that technique won't work. We give all the figures and calculations in the book. Well, I think there's some self-imposed ignorance going on in the SETI community. Romans 1 says that people who rebel against God's authority tend to engage in self-imposed ignorance. Evidence for that is I've spoken in Santa Cruz on the campus, UC Santa Cruz, and just off the campus within blocks. I've done that four times. Not once has a SETI scientist come to my talk, even though that's been the title of my talk each time. You think that would provoke at least a few of them to come. They won't come. So I think they're engaging in self-imposed ignorance. Some of the people I know who are involved in the SETI program are quite forthright in admitting there's no way natural transport or even purposeful transport is feasible. So the idea that there might be another planet out there with intelligent life on it, sending life to planet Earth, they say can't happen. The distances are just too great. Technology is not going to help, no matter how advanced the technology would be. However, I think what's really driving the SETI camp is to say, even though they can't come to us, maybe they can communicate to us, and if they communicate to us, maybe they can send us a message that will help us to solve all the problems that we human beings face. And my response to those SETI people is, we already have that communication. It's here. All you got to do is read it. This did come from an extraterrestrial, a real transcendent extraterrestrial who really knows what he's talking about. So, but that's what's going on in SETI, yes. Well, you know what? I've been at the U.S. Center for World Mission. There's actually scholars there who are thinking about the fact that the fulfillment of the Great Commission might mean taking the gospel beyond planet Earth, because maybe God created these beings who are in a fallen state. But personally, I think Romans 9 and 10 is rather explicit in saying one time, one place for all. And therefore, I would say to Christian organizations, save your money. Focus on reaching people for Christ on planet Earth, because I think Scripture gives us some good boundaries. Now, I mean, again, I say there could be grass elsewhere. There could be dolphins elsewhere. Although I'll give you my theological perspective on this. I don't believe that God wastes his creation miracles. What would be the purpose of his creating dolphins on another planet? What would be the purpose of his creating grass on another planet? Now, maybe God has a purpose, but frankly, I can't think of one in the context of the message of why he created his universe. Created his universe for the express purpose of bringing redemption to the human species, bringing about a conquest of evil, and instructing the angels. Well, maybe there's something the angels need from dolphins on another planet, but I can't see anything in the Bible that would support that proposition. Okay. Romans chapter 1, starting in verse 18, going down to verse 32. That's the most explicit passage in the Bible that talks about the human propensity to ignore what you already know to be true, and why we tend to do that. Okay. Psalms. Let's get into Psalm 38. Job 38. Sorry. Yeah, sir. Job. I got confused. That was a sermon, was Job, or Psalm 38, and we're studying Job 38 in class. Okay, we've been through this chapter where we've paralleled what it says relative to the six creation days in Genesis 1. As we've noticed, this chapter actually gives us scientific details in every one of the six creation days in Genesis 1. We're going to find that again when we study Psalm 104 and also in Proverbs chapter 8. But You know, as you read through Job 38, this is the first time that God interrupts the debate. These five men have been having a debate with one another, and the Lord speaks. And he doesn't really so much give a sermon here as he asks a bunch of questions. So he says to the five assembled men, I got a little quiz here for you about creation. Let's see how well you do. And if you go through the chapter, you'll see that God poses 60 questions. Now, it depends how you count it. One way I came up with 58 questions, another way I came up with 65 questions, but somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 questions the Lord asks of these five men. And in the context of the five men, how many can they answer correctly? The answer is zero. In their context, they cannot answer a single one of these questions. Now, the question I pose to all of you is, you know, we've got 3,500 years of scientific research on these five men. How well can we do today relative to them? And the answer is, of the 60 questions, we can give a decent, well-understood answer, an answer that we're confident is correct, to 9 of the 60 questions. So we're not a whole lot better off than the five men who were debating one another about God's revelation and creation. Now, I'd like to give you a basic theme as we jump into these 60 questions. What we know and understand about the natural world, about creation, powerfully testifies for the God of the Bible. And that's really what these five men are dialoguing about. You know, we have three that are opposing Job, but if you read what they say, they too give a lot of evidence for the fact that look at nature and look what we can learn about God by studying nature. The natural realm powerfully testifies to the fact that there's got to be a God who is very powerful, who is exceptionally wise, and is very caring and loving. That comes through in spite of all the philosophical errors that these five men are committing in their debate. That comes through loud and clear from every one of them. So that's one place where they all agree, that the natural world powerfully testifies of the God of the Bible. Now, what the Lord brings up in Job 38 is he says, here's another testimony for me, what you don't know. What we know powerfully testifies of God, and the theme of Job 38 and Job 39 is what you don't know will also powerfully testify for him. Now, the reason I'm bringing this up is that so often when I'm talking to unbelievers, atheists, agnostics, they bring up what's called the God of the gaps. Ever heard that argument, the God of the gaps? You Christians always stick God in where you don't know and understand things. And that's an illegitimate argument for the existence of God. And in one sense, I'd say, well, you've got a point. We can argue for God's existence based on what we do know and understand. But what I find interesting here in Job 38 is the Lord is making a case that an even more powerful argument for the existence of God is what we don't know and what we don't understand. Now, let me just give you an example. You know, what's the simplest living thing we see on the planet today that can live on its own? Well, a bacterium with about 1,500 gene products. Well, if we really know and understand this well, and if it's natural process that's responsible for this simplest life form, then it should be trivial for us scientists today to make one of these things in the lab. Okay? How far have we gotten in terms of trying to make a life form? You know, by the way, there are biochemists out there that are really working hard to make life in the lab. And, you know, Buzz and I went to a conference where they told us about their latest research results on making life in the lab. But how far did they come? Well, in the most dramatic evidence that we saw for making life in the lab was putting 40 nucleotides together into a chain. Okay? So that's kind of the first small little piece of RNA or DNA. But in terms of making an entire RNA molecule, they can't get any closer than simply putting 40 isomers together. Likewise with the DNA. Only 40. so they're not even, and not only that, what they discovered is the more isomers you link together. In other words, maybe I should just give you a little bit of background here in the biochemistry. What's a DNA molecule? It's a twisted strand, two strands that are twisted around one another, and each strand is a very long chain of nucleotide molecules linked to one another. And so what these biochemists have been trying to do in the lab is say, well, let's see if we can make one of these RNA or DNA molecules. Now, let's not worry about the double helix thing. Let's just see if we can make a single strand. And let's see how long of a strand of nucleotides we can make. And let's not worry about whether the nucleotides are in the right order or not. We'll skip that. Let's just see if we can link them together in any order that we can. The best they can come up with is 40. And what they also discover is the more they try to link, the harder it gets. And so in terms of how much energy and design you've got to put into the system and the experiment, it basically goes up exponentially with the number of nucleotides you try to link together. So to go from step 1 to 39 is a lot easier than to go from step 39 to 40. So just one little step is more effort than the rest of the experiment combined. And so going to number 41 would be even greater than going from 1 all the way up to 40. And they said that discovery alone, the fact that the effort and energy you have to put into the system, the control you got to put into the system, goes up exponentially with the number of isomers, says this is impossible. There's no way this is going to work under any conceivable naturalistic program. There's no way we can do it in the lab. And that, of course, raises the question, well, how then did it happen? Well, here I would argue that is a legitimate argument based on ignorance and lack of understanding for why God's the only answer. Because if there was no God, this should be a trivial problem to solve. The fact that we can show it's not a trivial problem, we don't have a solution, we lack the understanding of how this works from a naturalistic perspective, therefore that's an argument for God. And what we're seeing here in Job 38 is God asks a series of questions, and each question is in that category. You know, even if you can figure it all out, what's it going to tell you? It's going to tell you, from a naturalistic perspective, this can't happen. This takes the fingerprint of God to make it work. So, in one sense, we're going to see all 60 questions are, quote, the God of the gaps argument. But it's a God of the gaps argument that's completely legitimate. And what I see in this chapter, in chapter 39, this is actually a more powerful way to argue for the existence of God than the stuff that you do know and understand. It's what we don't know and don't understand, where we should know and understand. That's where the God of the gaps argument really works well. If you can prove to the scientists, if there is no God, you should know this, you should understand this, but you don't. You don't even have a clue as to the first steps. Therefore, this requires the hand of God to explain. Now, a true God of the gaps argument. Many of you may not realize this, but I do have some speech handicaps I've struggled with since I was born. I wasn't even talking until I was nearly 6 years of age. I had to take some training to overcome this. I'm still taking training to overcome this, so please. But yeah, a legitimate God of the gaps argument from an atheistic perspective is where the Christian is arguing for God's existence because we don't understand, in arenas where scientists haven't even tried to understand. Okay, there I say they got a case. In other words, it's illegitimate for us as a Christian to say, hey, we don't know what's going on here, therefore God must have done it. That's an illegitimate argument if we human beings haven't even tried to understand, or we haven't poured any research effort into it. But if we have poured significant research effort into it, where on the assumption God doesn't exist, we should figure it out. We must figure it out. Then I think you've got a legitimate case saying, okay, we don't know, we don't understand. If there is no God, we must know and understand, but we don't. Therefore, God must have done it. So a little bit of a long-winded introduction, but my whole point is when we go through Job 38, we're going to see that over and over again. But I think the example I gave you, can we make life in the lab? Well, if life is easy to make under a naturalistic condition, then yeah, we should be able, that we should have done that 200 years ago. But we can't do it, and the more biochemical sophistication and technical expertise we get, the more obvious it becomes that we're not going to be able to do it. Yes. Yeah, I mean, in order to make it work, to link them together, they all have to have the same handedness. Otherwise, they're not going to link together appropriately. But they basically take the different isomers, the amino acids or the nucleotides, and they chemically force them to link. And if you're only linking two, it's not that difficult to do. If you're linking three, it's an order of magnitude more difficult than linking two. If you're linking four, an order of magnitude, that's the whole point. You're actually adding an order of magnitude as you step from three to four to five to six. What's part of the problem is as you link them together, they will fall apart. And you've got to put them back together again. So that's kind of where the energy comes in. You know, what they say in the research papers is the energy we have to input into the experiment goes up exponentially. Why? Because these isomers keep falling into place. We've got to keep putting them back in, hold them there, we get another one in place. So it's kind of the juggler analogy. As you add balls that you're juggling in the air, it gets progressively more difficult because there's a propensity for one to fall out of place. But that's not the only thing that's posing to be a problem. They discover as they're linking these things together, they've got to control the conditions. The temperature must be much more carefully controlled if you're trying to link five as opposed to linking two. So, we do give some references to that in the Origins of Life book if you want to read some of the papers where they ran into these limits. But when Fuzz and I were at the last Origins of Life conference, an entire afternoon with about 20 papers was devoted to just that one problem. Can we break the 40 isomer barrier? I remember one guy, he got all excited and says, I've done it. I've got the 41. So, but then he described the elegance of his experiment, and then one guy asked him a question, well, how long did it stay at 41? Well, not very long at all. And the whole point is 41 doesn't even get you close. I mean, you know, some of these molecules have thousands, so what are you going to do? So that's what really put a pall of depressing feeling where they all went out and got their Prozac afterwards and realizing this just isn't working. So, yes. Now, an isomer is a catch-all term which just means a base molecule. So for proteins, the base molecule would be the amino acids. For RNA, it would be the nucleotides. Oh, no. 1,500 would be, those are 1,500 gene products. Okay. A gene would be a piece of the DNA, and it's a piece that gives the blueprint for manufacturing one of the proteins. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so a gene and a gene product, that's how much blueprint would be required to give the plan for the construction of a single protein. And so you need 1,500 of these blueprints because there's 1,500 proteins that must be built and function within the cell. So that's about the minimum level of complexity for the simplest life form. And as we show in our book, that's both a theoretical calculation and an experimental confirmation. 1,400, you might be able to get down to 1,400. But 1,400 to about 1,700 is about the minimum you need for the simplest independent life form. Well, that's why we got a glossary at the back. Yeah, there's actually a glossary there which helps define all this stuff, yes.
And the 40 JV spoken in a row would be analogous to 40 of the 1,500, or is it 40 of these
would be part of what? Oh, no. I mean, like a single chromosome would have many gene products on it. And so. Well, you know what? You guys want me to get numbers. Richard, can you give me some numbers? What's the typical number of nucleotides in a chromosome? Yeah, in a chromosome. How about a... Hey, it's a big number. I know it's a really big number. I was just trying to give you an exact number. Okay, good. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, it's interesting you asked that question, because when these papers were presented at the Origin of Life conference, one of the scientists came to the microphone and actually posed that. He says, 40. Is there some numerological significance to the 40? And everybody just laughed. Well, no, it could be, but it's what they're noticing is that you get into this greater and greater experimental difficulty as you try to put these building blocks together, and depending on the experiment, you hit the barrier at 25 or 30. But by the end of the day, they said, even with the most sophisticated biochemical efforts, getting past 40 just seems impossible. In fact, one of these guys plotted a curve in front of all of us. You know, exactly how much chemical energy and control you have to put into the experiment as the isomer number goes up. And when you begin to get above 30, you get a straight line. It just goes up like that. And so, you know, it goes off to infinity. So in terms of making a single gene product, when you plot, well, you know, what is it going to take in the future for us to break the 40 barrier? Well, it's going to take virtually infinite effort to do it. It's not going to happen. On the other hand, I wouldn't be surprised if somebody with a lot of money gets to 43. You know, that could happen. Somebody might make it to 43. But 43 still isn't close to what you need, not even for just one of these gene products. Okay. I wasn't expecting we would take that long just to get through a little example. Yeah, what I did mean to say, however, when I picked this example of making life, is that the questions the Lord asks in Job 38 are more challenging, okay? So we kind of covered, kind of, quote, the easy one. We get more challenging ones here in the text. And it's all designed to bring humility. Yes. Okay, I mean, he's making the point, but, you know, it's simply the challenge. Hey, if you think life evolves naturally, then make it in the lab. And when you realize you can't even come close to the starting conditions in the lab, wouldn't that be adequate proof that the God of the Bible must exist? Shouldn't that settle the debate? Yeah, it would, if it wasn't for Romans chapter 1, verses 18 to 32. Which says that all of us have this tendency within to live our lives independent from God. The sin within us causes us to want to free ourselves from the authority of God. And therefore, in order to defend that perspective of pride and rebellion, we pretend that we don't know what we know. And it's really what it says in Romans chapter 1, that though they knew God, they chose to ignore him. And so the point that Paul makes in Romans, everybody knows that God exists. But there's a whole bunch of people on planet Earth today and in the past who are so rebellious against God, they chose to ignore what they clearly knew to be true about God. You know, Buzz and I got to see that firsthand at this conference. Hundreds of people, scientists, brilliant men and women at this conference. and the evidence was shouting at them. You know, and I read Psalm 19, where it says, the heavens declare the glory of God. You know, when you're sitting at a conference like that, and say, you know what, I've got another translation of that text. The heavens are shouting the glory of God. These isomers are shouting the glory of God, but they're deaf. They're not hearing what's going on. Why are they not hearing? We're talking about SETI. The SETI people ought to know that God exists, but they're deaf. And the deafness is what I saw firsthand when I took a course from Carl Sagan at the University of Toronto, because he was saying, you know, the only hope for mankind is that we make contact with the extraterrestrials, and they give us an Encyclopedia Galactica, and we read their book that'll give us all the answers to life. And, you know, I was the lone Christian in the group and made the point, well, don't we already have an Encyclopedia Galactica? You know, just very shyly, you know, don't we already have one? Carl's comment is, yes, but the moral challenge in the Bible is unacceptable, and therefore I reject it. Okay, now he was quite clear in making the point that, yeah, I mean, I know this book exists, but the morality that it proposes is just something I refuse to accept. So that's what's called the noetic effects of the fall. We fell in the Garden of Eden, and that fall says, look, I know God's standards are here, but I refuse to accept those standards. I will not have this man rule over me. Therefore, I'm going to go down path X. That's what's really going on. But yeah, 21st century, we should know. By the way, I'm over time. We didn't get very far in Job 38, but in one sense we did, because I really wanted to underline for all of you that, you know, there is a way we can use this God of the gaps argument to our benefit. And I can guarantee that as you talk to unbelievers, they're going to throw that in your face. And it's good to have a wise answer to that comment, well, you're just using the God of the gaps argument. Well, it's a good argument if used the right way. Let's bow for prayer. Father in heaven, what a privilege to be alive on the planet today. What an opportunity too, Lord, to be living at a time in history when it's so obvious the self-imposed ignorance that unbelievers are bringing down upon themselves. Lord, by your Spirit, I pray that you would give us the wisdom and the grace and the humility to allow the people we talk to see the degree that they've imposed ignorance upon themselves. And Father, help us by your Spirit to bring them into the light so they may see in a way they've never seen before your love, your truth, and your life revealed in the record of nature all around them, within their being. Allow them to see their conscience, Lord. Father, Richard Anderson talked about guilt today and how obvious guilt is. Guilt is painful to look at, but Father, give us the gentleness and the respect in our own clear conscience that we can help people see what you've been shouting at them in their conscience and the world around them. May we see many come to know you as Lord and Savior as a result. In Jesus' name, amen.